From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the new editor of the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service wants to paint a complete portrait of the neighborhoods they cover.
And so getting to know the community is my big thing, but getting to know me, anyone who knows me knows that I care about telling stories about those who don't get their stories told.
We'll learn about efforts to combat eating disorders at UWM and the ongoing consolidation of farms in Wisconsin.
We're sort of homogenizing our food cultures, which is a shame.
And why you shouldn't be too surprised by the extreme cold forecast for the beginning of March.
The weather is somewhat correlated with the seasons, but of course we know that there are other effects that can totally change the overall trend to having momentarily a blip in the temperature that you would expect.
Lake Effect is next after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. The online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service was launched in 2011 with the mission of creating in-depth coverage about central city neighborhoods. It was launched with the support from the Zilber Family Foundation and has since won local and regional awards for its coverage.
Things have evolved in recent days, and the news service now covers 18 neighborhoods and is a part of Marquette University. And even more recent news is the hiring of a new editor. Ron Smith has been on the job for less than a month, and he joins us in the studio to talk about his vision for the future of the Neighborhood News Service. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
Well, let me start with a pretty basic question. What's your aim, both in the immediate and maybe longer-term future for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service?
So for those who don't know, the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service covers communities of color in Milwaukee. It's been in existence for 8 years. Sharon McGowan was the founding editor, and I just started 3 weeks ago. So I'm brand new, but I have a lot of ambition for the organization. Two things that we want to do is to celebrate the community, so to continue telling stories that are positive and portrays the communities that we cover in a positive light. But the second part is illumination. I want to be able to shine light on issues and people that no other media outlet will do. So that involves doing more enterprise reporting, more original reporting, and actually for the first time having beats that will allow our reporters to cultivate sources and to, you know, get out in the community and break news instead of just kind of remaking it.
Where does developing talent fit in the mission of the Neighborhood News Service as well?
We're all about that. So the Dietrich College of Communication actually saved Neighborhood News Service. That's Marquette. In December, the NNS was about to close, and Marquette made a commitment to keep it open. So part of my jobs, is being an instructor of practice in the journalism department. So we're going to be working with journalism students, UWM, MATC, along with the community to train them how to write, how to report. So developing that kind of talent. And then we have a paid staff of part-timers. We have about 5 or 6 and constantly working on their skills as well. So I see it as both serving the community and teaching the community.
Now, you are new to the Neighborhood News Service, but you are not new to Milwaukee, right?
I am not new to Milwaukee. I have 13 aunts and uncles, and 6 live here in Milwaukee. I was the deputy managing editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel before I left in 2016 to become the ME for news at USA Today. So it's kind of fun to come back in this space and to build things that I think are so important in our community.
Well, and so where do you see the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service fitting in with the more traditional forms of media, such as you have worked for in the past?
I don't think it fits in, and that's the attraction about it is because I don't think, even at its best, other media ever covered these communities before. And now each organization is facing challenges with cutbacks and the loss of staff. So it becomes more important for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service to make it distinct from other media. And so what we're going to do is just keep on covering what we know how to do and let, you know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel does what it needs to do. But our focus is really going to be on the communities, acting as a watchdog for them and also acting as a champion for them.
Well, and so when you think about who the Neighborhood News Service is serving. Do you see yourself and the organization as illustrating the reality of these communities to the outside or holding up a mirror for the community to see itself?
Both. I think that's a really good question. I think that we have a lot of readers who care about those communities. I'm not sure that we are reaching our target audience in a way that I would want. So I want to step up that presence. I want to, again, educate, celebrate, illuminate. And so those three topics are really near and dear to me because I feel like the purpose of NNS is to provide a complete portrait. It's not a PR agency, but when you look in the mirror, sometimes you see something good. I hope you see something good. Sometimes you see something bad. Sometimes you see something ugly. We want to focus on the good and then shine light on the bad and also keep our politicians accountable because there's no one looking at them.
What's the, you know, what is the getting to know you process like for you, having been both at USA Today and then before that at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel? This is a much different kind of news organization. What does it take for you to kind of feel like this is, you know, this is yours?
I already feel like it's mine. it's a very good question. You know, my background, I've worked before Milwaukee at the Oregonian, at the LA Times, Newsday. But I started at an African-American weekly in Los Angeles called the Wave Newspaper Group, and I covered City Hall to county and things like that. I also worked for a nonprofit in Chicago called New Expression, which was a citywide teen publication that went to all the high schools, and I served as the advisor. So I feel like every job has led to this job. And so getting to know the community is my big thing, but getting to know me, anyone who knows me knows that I care about telling stories about those who don't get their stories told. So combining the experiences from working at a small outlet to working at the big ones, I think has positioned me, I think, to take it to the next level.
Well, and so as you've taken a look at what the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service has been about, has looked like, has been able to accomplish throughout, you know, its first incarnation, are there things that you're looking to change right away? Are there things you're looking to improve on? Are there things that you think it already does especially well?
So the Neighborhood News Service does really well with the celebratory stories, right, telling positive stories. But what I wanted to focus on is originality, so breaking news as well. So actually, it's funny you should say this. On Friday, we're meeting as a staff to talk about what NNS is, what we're going to do, which means what we're not going to do because there's only so many people and so much time. But for the first time, we're actually going to take on beats. So we're going to talk about how do we cover NPS, how do we cover NPD, how do we cover health, jobs, things that we think our readers need to know. And I want to take it to the next level. Right now, I feel that NNS is kind of functioning as a weekly newspaper on digital footprint. And I want it to become much more multimedia, involving videos, podcasts, and things like that. And also to be bold. We have nothing to lose by being creative. There's no one who's going to stop us. There's no one who will say no but us. So we just have to focus, focus, focus. And I want to continue to elevate what Sharon McGowan left me, which was a great gift. But my goal really is for it to become a media powerhouse.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the dire financial position that that NNS was in a few months back. How are you feeling about the long-term security of the organization with funding from Marquette at this point?
I'm feeling really good about it. One thing Marquette did was put me on their salary line, so it's not coming from NNS. Also, places like Zilber and Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Cole Foundation, they've all, among many, have stepped up to help us. So Sharon McGowan did a lot of work making sure that we were funded for the year. So the next goal for me is to have a five-year plan. And I've been working with Marquette Advancement. I'm always looking for donations. But I feel that we are in a good point right now in our next chapter, and I'm just hoping for the best.
Well, and maybe this is an unfair question given that we're talking and you've only been on the job for 3 weeks. But what are the things, the challenges you see out there? Are they, you know, are they funding challenges? Are they journalism challenges? Are there things that are already keeping you up at night?
Well, I think there's a couple challenges, right? You're always worried about the money. We're just going to keep coming. That's always going to be a constant. And, you know, luckily there are people who want to help us, and they have responded quite well to my plea. Second would be just making sure the staff has the training that it needs to deliver high-impact journalism. We take people from the freshman who walks into Marquette to senior professionals like Edgar Mendez and Andrea Waxman and other folks who have been around since its inception, but it still takes a lot of work because it's part-time, right? So what keeps me up at night is working at NNS, and that's fine. But what also keeps me up is the mission, and that's the most important thing. Everyone I'm working with appreciates that we have a mission. We know what that mission is, and just to achieve that will be, you know, something that will keep me up at night worrying, you know, how do we do it? But we will.
You mentioned these various other stops in your career before this point. Do you have the same sense of excitement starting a job like this as you had in, you know, each of these other steps along the way?
I think I have more excitement. You know, I was at USA Today, and that's owned by Gannett. And recently there were layoffs, scores of people were laid off, and that's something that has been happening in the news field for a while now. So it's actually nice to come here and build something. It has its own challenges as a nonprofit, but it's nice to have an impact on some of the young talent, work with some of the older folks, bring the community in. I just think that it's mission work. And even though I may have worked 13 to 14 hours a day at USA Today, which I still dearly love, it doesn't feel like it at NNS. And sometimes I have to set my alarm, like, time for you to go. So it's rewarding in that way.
Ron Smith is the new editor for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. He comes to the job after a stint at USA Today, 13 years at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and experience at several other newspapers.
We will take a quick break now and then learn how one clinic is combating the issue of eating disorders among college students. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR.
Back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. National survey data estimates as many as 20 million women and 10 million men in the United States will have an eating disorder at some point in their lives. Those disorders can range from anorexia to bulimia, binge eating, fasting, compulsive exercising, and more. These are serious but treatable mental and physical illnesses that can affect people of any age and background and can have lifelong consequences and struggles.
They're also issues that can pose real problems on college campuses as students are making the transition to adulthood. Dr. Stacy Nye is the supervisor for the UW-Milwaukee Eating Disorder Clinic. Tomorrow, the group will host an event on eating disorders, including a screening of the documentary The Student Body. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about how the clinic does its work on campus.
The Eating Disorder Clinic is part of the Psychology Clinic at UW-Milwaukee. So the Psychology Clinic is a training clinic for the PhD clinical psych graduate students. So it's where they have their practicum. They learn how to do psychotherapy there, and it's all supervised by the UWM faculty. We have an eating disorder clinic, among other clinics, housed within the psychology clinic. We provide outpatient psychotherapy and consultation to the community, to students.
This week is Eating Disorder Awareness Week. And to start, what are some of the main eating disorders and their symptoms? You know, things like anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, you know, compulsive exercise. It kind of runs the gamut. So what are some of the main ones that people should be familiar with?
The main ones that are in our diagnostic manual are anorexia nervosa, which is restrictive eating and often severe weight loss, and denial of what's happening with often distorted body image and a sense that, you know, someone is fatter than they really are. Bulimia nervosa, which is a disorder of binge eating and then purging either by self-induced vomiting or excessive exercise or restricting. Binge eating disorder is the binge eating part without necessarily any compensatory behaviors. So those are the main ones that we see. There are certainly other eating disorders as well.
What do you think the greatest misconceptions are about eating disorders?
I would say one of the greatest misconceptions is that people are doing it for attention and that they can just eat and they just don't want to.
How does that affect the people going through these eating disorders, whether they are aware and accepting of it or not, to have that misconception placed upon them?
Well, there's often a lot of shame involved in having an eating disorder, and often people delay seeking help because they're worried about being judged. It's harder to avoid treatment when you're anorexic because often you've lost so much weight that people start to notice and get concerned. First, they actually become very complimentary. We live in a society where when someone loses weight for any reason, people start complimenting them. So first, it's very reinforced, and then they keep going losing weight, and then people start to get concerned and bring them into treatment. With bulimia nervosa, it's often not visible from the outside. They don't necessarily lose a lot of weight. And so often people with bulimia wait up to 5 years before seeking treatment. So there's a lot of shame involved and a lot of fear of change.
Where does someone start if they believe that they have an eating disorder or perhaps on the verge of something serious, or even if they know something's up but they're not quite accepting and not ready for help? What are some ways people can take initiative on their own, say, before coming to the clinic?
Well, I would say they should talk to someone. They could talk to their doctor. They could talk to their school counselor. They could try talking to their parent. They could go online and not just look anywhere, but they could go to some of the recognized sites like the National Eating Disorders Organization that sponsors Eating Disorders Awareness Week. It's NEDA, N-E-D-A. They could take a screening there and see if they have an eating disorder. But I would say talking to an adult or a trusted friend to get some help first.
And in what ways does your clinic and the graduate students conducting therapy sessions, in what ways do they have to be mindful of when it comes to treating people with eating disorders? What are some of the protocols that are followed, or just things that are more needed in these kind of sessions compared to the other services that you offer at the clinic?
All of the services provided at the clinic are led by graduate students, both testing and all the psychotherapy. It's all video recorded, and everyone knows that coming in. They sign a release to approve that, and that's how the faculty can directly monitor and supervise the psychotherapy. So one of the differences between treating someone with an eating disorder versus treating someone with simply an anxiety disorder would be often there are medical complications involved with an eating disorder. It's important that the graduate students are involved with often primary care docs or pediatricians and sometimes dietitians. So there's often some coordination of care that goes on that doesn't necessarily happen in one of the other clinics in the psychology clinic. Physicians really appreciate being involved and knowing what's happening with their patients, and they appreciate having someone who is helping their patients, you know, to get the help that they need.
Do you see any pattern or higher rate of any particular eating disorder in college students?
Well, when people go to college, it's a big transition, and times of transition are often times that people have trouble. So it's not unlikely that someone might develop a depressive episode or anxiety or an eating disorder. People joke that, you know, your first year of college, you might gain 10 pounds with all of the late night studying and drinking and pizzas and things like that. So it's certainly a time when people can start to have trouble. We do have a lot of people coming in. We're actually full at the moment and have a short waiting list. It depends on how many graduate students we have available at the time. But I think it's a great service. And not only that, it's important to me that we're also involved in the greater community.
You deal with a wide range of spectrum of clients at the clinic. Do you find that the rates of eating disorders differ between men and women?
Well, it's not that it affects women primarily, but it does tend to affect women more. But I would say that is changing all the time because pressures to be thin and fit really affect all of us, no matter what your gender is. So I think we're going to learn more and more about men and transgender people coming out with and acknowledging that they have eating issues. Again, I think there is a lot of shame, particularly with men acknowledging they have an eating disorder because it's a misconception that it only affects women.
I imagine the landscape of learning about various eating disorders and the way they affect people has changed over the years since it's been diagnosed and chronicled. Do you find that today's digital landscape has heightened people's consciousness of the pressure to be thin, to be fit, to eat a certain way?
Are you talking about social media? Absolutely. It used to be that we were very concerned about television and movies and magazines. And there has been research about mothers who read certain magazines tend to have daughters with body image issues. But now we're seeing, as younger and younger kids even have access to social media, the social comparison has really skyrocketed. Instantly, you can open up your phone and see pictures of, you know, very thin, possibly Photoshop pictures of many celebrities. And there's the social comparison is really strong. There is a lot of fat shaming that goes on social media and bullying, although I'm starting to see a little more backlash towards that. But I would say that we've seen an increase in certainly just disordered eating and body image issues and self-esteem issues in young people with the, you know, tremendous rise of social media.
Dealing with eating disorders or body image at the very least is something we all deal with all of our lives. And women in particular can experience many different changes to their body, you know, especially say if they go through pregnancies and their relationship with their body and the way it looks or how they feel. How do you find this complicates a person's treatment, recovery, stability, the whole gamut?
Well, I think you're right, because women's bodies tend to change a lot through their lifetime. So, and men's bodies also, but in a kind of a different way. So women, as women go through puberty, their body changes a lot. They tend to put on a lot of weight before they develop. And so a lot of parents get worried about that as their pre-adolescent gains weight. They start freaking out that their kid is getting fat. That's a time that sometimes someone might call me. Then with development, then their body is changing in a more sexual way, and that can be very stressful to young girls and men as well, young boys. There's also pregnancy, as you said. The first few months of pregnancy, when you don't look pregnant but you've gained some weight, women become, you know, very concerned and self-conscious during those times. Or once you've had a baby and you still are carrying some pregnancy weight, women are very self-conscious at those times. And now what I'm more familiar with is menopause, when your metabolism slows down and you might put on some weight as a result of that. A lot of my friends talk about that a lot. But the main thing I really want to stress is it's really important that you love yourself and love your body no matter what it looks like. Our focus on our bodies as a tool for other people to judge is really concerning. I really want to help people to develop their whole person.
Dr. Stacy Nye is the supervisor for the UW-Milwaukee Eating Disorder Clinic. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of an event tomorrow evening in which several campus services will host a free screening of the documentary, The Student Body, along with online screenings for eating disorders and a discussion with the filmmaker. You'll find more information and resources at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then contributor Dave Kozlowski joins us to talk about fighting the rising tide of farm consolidation. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. We've done plenty of stories on the farm-to-table or locavore movement at restaurants and among some consumers. But when it comes to your weekly grocery shopping, how much of it involves support for local agriculture?
The view from two local farmers is not enough. And that's backed up by data. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says the percentage of small farms has dropped from 46 to 25% of the total since 1991. But is there an antidote to that trend?
To help put some perspective on the issue and offer some suggestions, we turn to farming contributor Dave Kozlowski, who operates Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek. He's joined by Kirsten Jersick, president of the Southeast Chapter of the Wisconsin Farmers Union and a local cattle farmer. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and Kozlowski explains the key factors he thinks contributes to the current state of local agriculture.
We're in trouble in a couple of different ways. Farmers aren't making money, and we're not attracting new farmers into the business. And I think the public seems to be falling farther and farther away from where their food is produced. And so it's a parallel crisis, if you will.
When would you say the last time that the public was actively engaged and interested in where their food came from?
I feel like we get further away from it every year as our farms consolidate and get larger. So I feel like even 40 years ago, a lot of people had a family farm. At least they had some connection to their grandparents' family farm. It might have been a place they went for a couple days in the summer or a week in the summer, and they had on-farm experiences, which made them think a little bit more about farms. But as we have less and less small farms, we have less and less people that are associated with a farm, and it's sort of a downward spiraling association. And so farm consolidation is happening faster and faster in the state of Wisconsin and all over the country. So we have less people with a direct tie to a farm.
You'd also have to sort of define what you mean by public, because, you know, there was a significant contingent of people, 70s through the early 90s, who were really hooked into farms and getting local food and things like that. But of late, at least since the late 90s and into the 2000s, things sort of been going the other direction. People are becoming less connected to their farms.
So we have, you know, of course, technology is always a double-edged sword. On one hand, we get more food supply, but then on the other hand, people, like you said, are not as connected to where our food is coming from. So how does our modern food culture feed into the issues with this big food system itself?
At least on my side of the business, with the produce, fruit, and vegetable side, it's sort of both. There's a contingent of very, very large farms that probably continue to get large, but they are doing some wholesaling, but also just a lot of sort of canning and freezing and things like that. You know, the Bird's Eye and the Green Giant and things like that. And then on the other side are a lot of the farms more along our size, say from 20 acres to 80 acres of produce, that are hanging in there. They're not growing. We're not attracting a lot of new young people to the business. Some, but not a lot. So they're hanging in there, but they're not growing in number.
And how about for your end, Kirsten? Because you're in beef, right?
Yes, I raise grass-fed beef.
Yeah.
And there are still a lot of small grass-fed beef farms across the countryside. But I guess when you look overall at the statistics, you know, if about 60 to 65% of all of our food comes from 3% large farms. You know, that's kind of a really eye-opening number. The dairy industry has just been in terrible crisis over the past 2 years, and the number of dairy farms going out of business is just alarming and very scary.
So what does this mean for, you know, your average person going into Pick and Save or Woodman's or a Piggly Wiggly here? They have the convenience of being able to go to the freezer section to get a bag of vegetables or, you know, go to the butcher counter and get all this stuff. So how can we make the connection more visible for the people doing their grocery shopping? And their only concern about the grocery shopping is, I need to go grocery shopping, and that's it.
That's a big food culture change right there that would have to take place. Now, there is a tiny bright spot in that some of the large grocery chains, you know, I'm thinking of Woodman's, see who owns Pick and Save now?
Kroger?
Kroger.
Yeah.
Yeah. they're buying some local and they're highlighting it. So I say it's a tiny bright spot because it's raising some awareness that food actually does come from a farm. It just doesn't arrive, you know, in your grocery basket in a styrofoam shrink-wrapped package.
Right.
So that's helping. And I think they're doing it not because they're being altruistic, but because there is a incipient resurgence of an interest in the local food, and the grocery stores are picking up on that. I mean, it makes good marketing for them.
Absolutely. And good community relations. Do you see that as well?
Yes. I think a lot of people want to think their food comes locally. I guess what we've sort of run into as direct marketers in the last maybe 5 years is the consumer base that wanted local, really healthy, organic food would maybe have to seek us out a little bit. And now you can go to Whole Foods and buy anything that we can raise here. And it's real convenience, and a lot of it is not from the area. And I think most of the smaller stores, well, not smaller stores, but ones that specialize in organics and grass-fed and have a lot of options. A lot of, like at Costco, you can buy grass-fed beef. Most of it's imported.
You know, what I've seen where this is beginning to take off is with restaurants. Restaurants, chefs have recognized the fact that, well, local food not only tastes better, but their clientele are demanding it. One chef told me that you really can't have a successful restaurant in this town unless you're buying some local. I don't know if that's true or not. I think there's a lot of successful restaurants that are buying local. But his point meaning that, you know, there is a rising demand from the consumer side to do this. And we can do the same thing with grocery stores if they start talking to their produce managers and their meat managers and saying, you know, I really would like to know where this comes from. Or could you get this? Or this is available. You know, we have the food hub, which brings together food from all over the place, and you can buy it bulk by the pallet loads and things like that. I mean, that's something that certainly would interest grocery stores, I would imagine, if they recognize the demand for it.
We also have the Wisconsin Grass-Fed Beef Co-op for grass-fed beef that does the same thing and is in, like, Outpost and a lot of stores it's in.
Do you think that there are these same issues to the same degree in different countries that aren't America that don't make such a business out of it? I mean, whether that is because of location, transportation abilities, things like that. Do you think it's truly a global problem, or do you think America is particularly, you know, setting the worst example for sustainability in their market?
It's a global problem. There was a wonderful book out, it came out 10 years or 12 years ago, called Hungry Planet, What the World Eats. And it's a writer and a photographer went across the globe getting families to assemble what they purchase for a week's amount of groceries. And in almost every one of the photos, except for like the family in Chad, Africa, or and there's another African country, there's processed food in there. I mean, it's just potato chips, and it's the local brand of potato chips, but it's potato chips, you know? So globally, we're sort of homogenizing our food cultures, which is a shame. You know? We sort of industrialized the process and made it so much cheaper and convenient for people to buy things packaged and processed than to actually cook it at home.
I feel like a lot of people don't realize how heavily, heavily subsidized the agricultural industry is, large-scale egg. Our processed food is seemingly cheap, but the farmers themselves receive federal government subsidies when prices fluctuate.
So if sales don't do as good for a particular product in 1 month,
or it's more a demand supply issue, if there's a surplus and so corn prices are low, then, you know, producers receive subsidies. And so while the public may think that their food is cheap, they're not taking the tax equation into the equation of what we're overall paying for our food. We're not taking things out of the farm bill and adding those into what we might otherwise be paying for our food, right, to keep our farmers in business. And without those subsidies, we would lose a lot of farmers. So it would be a whole nother tragedy. But it's an equation that I feel the general public doesn't have a real strong understanding of.
Well, and on the note of money, that's also something that I think is very important when it comes to changing food culture, is not everyone can afford to go to that restaurant that sources locally. Not everyone can afford to, say, go to Outpost or Whole Foods. And they're just worried about getting groceries that are accessible to them. And in Milwaukee especially, you know, we have food deserts and we have some local farmers markets and other efforts that are trying to reduce that. But in a food culture, in a food industry state that segregates people and their access to food based on how much money they make, how do you think the playing field can be leveled a little bit, that people can be more informed and more passionate about where their food comes from versus I just need to get my food?
Cooking isn't a hard thing to do. It's not really a hard thing to learn. And it's a wonderful thing to do. It's enjoyable. It's wonderful family time. It's just quality time. And so by actually buying healthful whole foods and cooking them yourself, your grocery bill isn't going to change a whole lot by other than buying processed foods. Maybe $1.50 a week. So $1.50 a week. Where do we all waste $1.50? You know,
anywhere.
Anywhere, right? Yeah. So just by cooking.
that is really big. That's a big change. I mean, people eat out more than they cook at home. And I don't think they realize how much money they're spending when they're eating out. I would first of all argue that local food is not necessarily more expensive. It can be, but it's not necessarily more expensive. And second, I'd argue they'd save so much more money, as Kirsten says, if they were just cooking their food at home, enjoying it, getting the sense of pride. You know, I mentioned that book earlier. There's a picture in that book of an Ecuadorian family with the food in front of them. And what made them really stand out was it was mostly raw food, so they had to cook it. But he looked so dang proud of what he has there and the few dishes that they did cook that were laid out there. Whereas you look at, some American families, and they're spread of food in the front, and they have this sort of forced smile that you put on when you're having your portrait taken. You know, there's no connection to their food, where this Ecuadorian farmer really had a connection to his food and the food that they ate and the family ate. And I think we can get that sort of sense of cultural love for our food again if we're cooking it, if we're in the kitchen working with it. Plus, we'll waste a whole lot less if we're making it ourselves.
When it comes to encouraging cooking, changing, you know, we're all creatures of habits, and we've seen by example of the attempted soda tax in various states or even the pushback from Michelle Obama's, you know, healthy lunch programs. You know, when it comes to changing our food or changing the products that we buy with our own money, you know, there's such resistance. So how do you guys think that this could be implemented in a friendly way?
That's the big question. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? How do we convince people that buying food, cooking food is a good thing to do? You know, we've gotten so used to watching the cooking shows on TV where they make all this really fancy stuff that's, you know, we go, oh, that looks really good, but I can never make that. I don't have all these ingredients. I don't have it. And it, you know, and they look at it and they go, they do it in 20 minutes. And I go, I can never do it. It's all such nonsense, you know? If they would stop watching the Food Network and open up a recipe book, a cookbook, they could probably turn it around and they'd be amazed at how much they could cook and what they would know. And I don't know how we can help people do that more than just this, talking about it and taking some cooking classes.
Encouraging them to come to farmers markets and just talk to us where we're selling, because we give people recipes. People can go on our web pages and find recipes.
That is a really good point. Yeah, I think farmers markets are a great connection with the farmer, the food, and the cooking, because oftentimes we will put things out at the market they don't know what to do with, and they'll ask us. And we'll say, well, you know, I do this. No, that sounds good. And that's what it's going to take. It's going to take baby steps like that, you know. Or it's going to take maybe coming down to the open house, the CSA open house. You know, I'm always amazed at how people spend so much time interviewing doctors or lawyers, but they don't think about who grows their food. Well, there's an event that's done at the Urban Ecology Center on March 9th that is pulling together farmers from southeastern Wisconsin. And folks can come down there and talk to them about their CSA programs. Or maybe they're at a farmer's market, or maybe they sell direct, but they can find this out by actually talking to the farmer.
And that, I would imagine, also attributes to your motivation to cook more. You know who grew your food. You know where it's coming from. You want to, you know, do right by that.
It does. It does make a difference. I know we have a CSA program, and our members say that all the time, that the kids actually want their parents to cook the food because they saw it come out of the ground. They saw it get packed in the box. And it has a meaning. But yeah, these are baby steps. But if we just keep making them, eventually we can turn this food culture around. I'm sure of it.
Dave Kozlowski operates Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek with his wife, Sandy Rodenz. Kirsten Jurcek is president of the Southeast Chapter of the Wisconsin Farmers Union and a local cattle farmer. You'll find information about a local farmer open house on March 9th at the Urban Ecology Center at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then our astronomy contributor looks back at the unprecedented Martian success of NASA's Opportunity rover. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Astronomers, astrophysicists, and fans of space travel marked the end of an era earlier this month. After 15 years on the surface of Mars, the Opportunity rover mission finally ended after more than 6 months had gone by with no success in communicating with the craft.
The robotic exploration rover and its fellow vehicle called Spirit landed on Mars in 2004 with a planned mission of just 90 days, but both lasted well beyond scientists' expectations. Spirit signed off in 2010, but Opportunity lived on, capturing images and data and setting the record for most distance logged on the red planet, more than 28 miles.
Still, Lake Effect astronomy contributor Gene Creighton and our Bonnie North couldn't help but be a bit sad with the end of the mission.
Well, it's our spokesperson on Mars, right? It's one of our spokespersons on Mars. And what's amazing about this, the machine that could, is that, as we've heard now many times, it was designed to last for 90 days, and it's been there for almost 15 years. So this was truly a trooper that was able to traverse more than a marathon on Mars. It's going to be probably a long time before a person is able to do that.
And the kind of information that it collected and the kind of insights that we gained because of it are immeasurable almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What are some of the highlights that it did?
Well, that mission helped us see what we now fondly call the blueberries. So they look like blueberries in the pictures, and it's one of those, for the planetary geologists, they look at that and they say, oh, that's water. That is the sign that there not only was there standing water, but that it was there for a long time. These are the direct clues that you need before you can make statements like, yeah, the weather was probably good enough, but that is proof. We also are able to see the various types of terrain because we've now gone from big craters to smaller craters. We've been able really to understand more about the geological formations on Mars.
I remember back in the 90s when the first, and I don't remember which rover it was at this point, but I remember we were all glued to our televisions,
yeah,
waiting for those first images and standing there in front of the TV and thinking, I'm looking at Mars.
Right.
I'm looking at Mars.
Right.
Oh my, not an artist's rendition,
right,
but I'm actually looking,
right,
at it.
So that was Pathfinder,
because
okay, it was a proof of concept. There had been many failures, and you saw how, like, the thing was supposed to unfold. Chuka, 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 the thing was to come, supposed to come down. It was supposed to take a picture, and everybody was like, and it worked.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
And so that really ushered in the modern day Mars exploration, didn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Because we had a hiatus of all kinds of mishaps and crashes, uncommunicative machines, and then the light, da-da-da-da. And that really was also proof of concept that the idea that you could bounce a rover on Mars, it was a thing. And it works. Or that you could approach Mars and then have it very softly land like we tried with and succeeded with Curiosity. So getting something on Mars safely, softly is hard.
Yeah, among many other things about getting to Mars.
That's right, exactly. So I think curiosity, opportunity, spirit, but especially opportunity now since it's been there, a champion for so long, a veteran, if you will. It was just a little thing that could, and where spirit, you know, got stuck and we had to give up a long time ago, opportunity just kept on going. And that makes us all cheer.
Yeah. Well, let's bring things back to earth a little bit. And you mentioned something before we turned on the microphones that got me thinking. So, of course, now I want the answer. And you were talking about what makes the seasons happen here on Earth. And I realized that I kind of know, but I couldn't tell you. If somebody came up to me and said, explain to me how the seasons happen, I would say, well, I know it's got something to do with the tilt of the Earth and it's how it goes around the sun, but that's about as far as I could go.
Right. I suspect that most people, that's as far as they could go. And this was something they learned, you know, they feel like they ought to know this. They learned this in some part of their education, but it was fuzzy even at the time. So yes, it does have to do with the fact that the Earth is tilted. If the Earth was not tilted, we would not experience seasons. So that's one takeaway. Yes, the Earth is going, of course, around the sun. And because of this tilt, that means that sometimes in a given location, let's say in the northern hemisphere, the sun is going to be higher in the sky, which makes it more effective. That is the key point. If the sun is high in the sky, that means that a certain amount of radiation gets beamed in a area, let's call it A. And if you have the sun now at a low angle, that means that that very same energy gets distributed, let's say, in 2A area, which means that if you're standing, if you're a person standing in one of these areas, you're going to get more energy or less energy. To add insult to the injury, if we're approaching summer, then the days are also going to be longer. So not only is the sun more effective, but it has more hours in the day to work, which, of course, changes the temperature, the average temperatures that we see. So I think part of the various reasons to be confused here. One of the things is people use sometimes the term seasons, weather, and climate somewhat interchangeably, or maybe they're not clear on how they're different. So a season is something that's going to happen, rain or shine, those two things I mentioned, the height of the sun and the length of the day, rain or shine, that's going to happen. So I think it's interesting that trees don't respond to temperature because they've been tricked before. From an evolutionary standpoint, it doesn't make sense to just say, oh, warm day, I think I'm going to put my buds out. They wait for the length of day, which is a sure thing.
I have seen, though, trees budding early.
But then they arrest it.
Ah, so the
then
tree
they
knows.
Say, oh, yeah, no, that was too soon. And frankly, I think more likely bushes. So I have some silly crocuses on the side of my house. And the moment that the temperature does anything mildly above 50, they all say, wah. And they have gotten snowed upon so many times. So little plants don't put out so much energy so they can afford to make that mistake, but an old stately tree cannot. So they will wait. So if you notice, the maples will wait until the light has gotten really at a certain reliable
basically
place.
Basically the angle of the light.
Yep. Now the other time that people get confused because these terms sometimes are used interchangeably is they think, well, it's supposed to be spring, and then they complain, it's supposed to be spring, but look at the temperature. The weather is somewhat correlated with the seasons, but of course we know that there are other effects that can play, temperature of the lake, different kinds of currents if you live by the ocean, that can totally change the overall trend to having momentarily a blip in the temperature that you would expect. So it could be too hot or it could be too cold. Finally, another term that's related to these things is climate. Climates are long-term trends, and they can be superimposed. I mean, the seasonal stuff is happening anyway. Climate tells you if you're seeing tendencies as we are now, where the temperature is higher overall. That doesn't mean that one day it won't be excruciatingly cold, as we found out recently, But it's just telling you if you average out the temperatures over a period of time, you see a trend.
And the seasons are happening no matter what because of
the sun. Yep, every year you can literally set your clocks as we do based on that.
Well, and it explains why there really isn't much of a seasonal change around the equator.
That's right. One of the things that people have in their hearts, and I get it because we all have the experience of if I'm cold, I go closer to the heat source, and if I'm warm, I back off. People somewhere in the back of their minds remember those little pictures they saw in school books of elliptical orbits, and they figure, well, clearly we must be closer to the sun when it's warmer. It's useful to recall that we are closest to the sun around the 4th of January. And that's just telling us that the distance between the Earth and the sun only changes by 3%. It's really not a big deal. So that's not the reason why we have summer or winter. It has to do with the tilt of the Earth. And the distance to the sun is a minor effect. So that tells us that the winters in the southern hemisphere are going to be just a tad warmer than the average temperature in the northern hemisphere at wintertime. And that's about it.
So not much change at all.
Not much change, no. Because setting aside those exaggerated pictures of ellipses that everybody has seen in textbooks, if you look at the Earth from above, the Earth's orbit is very close to a circle. A circle is an ellipse.
Sure.
But the effect is very small, and you couldn't eyeball it. You required somebody like Kepler, who was a brilliant mathematician, to take 20 years of data to figure out, okay, Mars isn't exactly a circle. It is a bit elliptical. Just a little bit. I mean, a 3% is really a
not
very
much.
Mild
to
effect.
To the eye, it would
you wouldn't
around.
Be able to see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the textbooks exaggerate that so that you get in your mind what an ellipse looks like. But I think it perhaps reinforces that misconception that somehow the seasons are connected to the distance we have to the sun, which does change, yes, but only ever so slightly.
And doesn't have the effect that we all think it does.
It certainly doesn't, No.
So despite the fact that we're due to get more snow here in Milwaukee, the angle of the sun is going to predictably come and spring will happen. That's what you're telling me.
That is right. So have faith. This will happen. It might be delayed a few days, but we can be sure that the days are going to start getting longer than the nights, and that can't be changed by the weather. The sun is going to be getting higher every day. So even if it snows, the sun will beat it down.
Excellent. That is very good news. Well, Jean, hopefully the sun will beat it down by the time we talk next month, because it will be towards the end of March, and we should be having a lot more light in the sky and maybe even warmer temperatures to go with it, even though I know they're not related. But I want to thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you.
Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the campus of UW-Milwaukee and our regular astronomy contributor. You can find past conversations with her at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.